But the book of Job, this is part two. I did part one before. I'm going to overlap a little bit with a few of the facts just to bring this message up to date. It's probably going to take four parts to do it justice, but I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to try and fit what remains in this section or in this session alone. But so far as we know, the book of Job is the oldest book in the Bible so far as its writing, with the possible exception of the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis. For that matter, it may be the oldest book in the world that has been in continuous availability. It was written, as best as we can determine, about 2150 B.C. Job lived in that period between the scattering of the peoples with the Tower of Babel, probably several hundred years after that, but before the birth of Abraham. What's significant in the book of Job is revealed by not only what's not there, but as much as by what is there. In the book of Job, there's no reference to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. There's no reference to the tabernacle. There's no reference to the law, per se, as we would recognize in the Ten Commandments. There's no reference to a temple or anything like that. This was long before any of that came into being. The area of where Job lived is called the Land of Uz. It's referred to as the Land of the East, and people have had problems with that, saying that, well, east of Jerusalem, there's basically nothing. Well, it wasn't east of Jerusalem, it was east of something else, because Jerusalem didn't exist at that point in time. This was some 600 years before Moses, even. Now, Moses lived for a time in the land of Midian. Now, Midian is down in that lower part underneath that yellow lettering where it says Land of Midian. And there's a reference in Lamentations chapter 4, verse 21, that says Edom lived in the land of Uz. So Midian and Edom were somewhat overlapping in their area, and the land of Uz was either in between them or it encompassed parts of them. But it's a very ancient part of the world. Moses may have obtained a copy of the book of Job from his time in Midian, though it may have been some time later, and that could be how it was conveyed to us. Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, was a priest of Midian. We can read of that in Exodus chapter 18, verse 1. Uz was named after the grandson of Shem. Genesis 10:23 tells us that. But what's unique about the book of Job in the Old Testament is that it is the primary book that deals with what we would call Christian living principles. The other books in the Old Testament are more oriented to law and to history, whereas the New Testament is more oriented to theological matters and matters of living, righteous living. The book of Job is more like a New Testament book than old. But of course, it is ancient. And what's remarkable about the things that are in it is its antiquity. We're going to find things said in the book of Job that are astounding to realize what Job understood at that early date. And you have to wonder how he knew such things. Well, one of the ways he might have known was that his lifetime coincided with Noah. Noah died about 2 years before Abraham was born. Shem lived another 150 years beyond the time Abraham was born. So Job would have had exposure to people of great antiquity, and whatever they knew, he certainly would have conveyed to them. That brings up the question, is the religion, the religious ideas that we see in the book of Job, an illustration of what was understood and what was believed in ancient times? If so, that would suggest to us that many of the things, the prophetic items, and the, many of the religious doctrines that we know today were to some degree understood way back in time. And that's what is most most interesting about the book. Job lived some 200 to 250 years overall. That was his lifespan. And that coincides with the men of that era. Abraham, his father, lived for 205 years. So it's not uncommon. It was not an uncommon length of days. And he lived for, and as we can read in one of the in the final chapter of the book of Job, he lived for some 140 years after the incident that the book of Job focuses around. Job is referred to as being self-righteous. And that's been our explanation in the past, that that's what was wrong with Job. He was self-righteous. I'm not saying that's not correct. I'm just saying we might not fully understand the meaning of the term as it was understood at the time. We think of self-righteous in the sense of somebody who feels religiously superior to everyone else. They don't need correction. They know it all. Everything's fine with them. And they generally hold other people in contempt. That's what we would define as self-righteous. And in the modern sense, that's probably true. Self-righteous in this time, in Job's time, was more the idea that his righteousness was self-motivated. He attempted to be righteous in everything he did and thought on the basis of his own personal integrity. Not bad, not wrong. I'm just saying this is how Job was motivated. Now the question is, was Job's righteousness a result of God's Spirit? Do we have any reason to think so? From Job's own dialogue, do we have any reason to think that Job attributed his righteousness to God's Spirit? Now that question reflects back to what I just said about the definition of self-righteousness. See, Job credited himself for his righteous character, not so much God's Spirit. Not bad, but not complete either. So we can look at the book of Job, we can look at Job's experience as a process of bringing him down to the most base level possible and being raised back up afterwards. And afterwards, he had a relationship with God that he never had before. That's, I think, the important thing. But Job didn't understand what was happening to him. One day, everything was fine. He was the patriarch of his clan, and who knows how big that clan was. There are some details that we'll look at in a few minutes that tells us that Job was the head of a family. He offered offerings. Now, this is long before the law of Moses. Hundreds of years before, he offered offerings, as did, for that matter, Cain and Abel. The idea of offerings did not come in with Mount Sinai. But he was the priest, he was the patriarch of his greater clan. He offered offerings on behalf of his own family at times, just on the presumption that maybe they had committed sins of some sort. But Job understood the significance of burnt offerings, something to keep in mind. The book of Job portrays Job as a faithful man who honestly tried to do right before God. Not a bad thing at all. In fact, the book begins with this phrase. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright, and one that feared God and eschewed evil. God said that of him. How many people would have that said about them? This was an extraordinary man. Satan came before God. God pointed out Job to Satan. Said, did you see that guy? And Satan said, yeah, I see him. But he's only the way he is because you bless him. Take away his blessings and you see what happens. Well, it was allowed. All his blessings were wiped away. And it didn't change. See, Satan was operating on the premise that so many religious people do. Obey God and you will be blessed. Disobey God and you will be cursed. Except practical reality tells us that and how it happens at all. Many unrighteous people, and Job even comes to that, many unrighteous people who want nothing to do with God are immensely prosperous in this world. They don't get sick. They don't have huge health problems. They don't lose their families. Their businesses, their properties don't go bad on them. Now, some do, but I'm just saying. His point was, he's noticing that the wicked prosper in ways that you wouldn't expect. And the righteous suffer in ways that you wouldn't expect. Why? You can read all the way through the book of Job. You can read the Bible all the way through to the book of James, where he asks, why do the righteous suffer? And what answer does it give? It doesn't give an answer at all. Different reasons and different circumstances. But the righteous suffer. I think it's safe to say that the righteous suffer for an important reason when it happens. Because we learn things through suffering that a good and prosperous, trouble-free life we would never learn. Think about ourselves as the church experience. We've been through some real troubles. Things that would have squeezed the spiritual life out of us. But we endured through it. We learned a lot from it. We suffer the effects still. But we came out of that. We came through that experience far stronger than we would ever have been without it. I was writing to a longtime minister this week, where I made the point to him, and I said, you know, I don't mean to say this just for the sense of aggrandizing myself or anything like that. And I told him, I've heard others say the same thing, but the Takach era and the collapse of the WCG was the impetus for me to go on and learn things and to come to understand things that I never would have had all of that continued as it was, on and on and on. In other words, the experience, negative as it was, trying as it was, the experience was profitable in ways that I never would have guessed. I think most of us can say the same thing. We grew more from going through that experience than we would have had all things just continued on as they were. Job's experience, though he didn't know what was going on in the background, he didn't know about this Satan situation. He just saw his own physical circumstance. He saw the loss of all of his wealth, all of the cattle that he had. He saw the loss of all of his children, all at once, wiped away. Within hours, all of this happened. Only one witness survived the experience and ran to tell him what happened. And they're standing in line one after the other to tell him what a devastating blow that must be. And that went on for some time. Satan appeared before God once again. We don't know how long again it was afterwards, but God sort of rubbed it in his face that Satan was wrong about Job, wasn't he? Job was still on the same tack, and Satan was still on the same tack, and he said, Job will curse you to your face if you rob him of his health. Well, we know what happened there. He was struck with boils from head to toe in horrible pain. Covered in dirt, ashes, and whatever, rags. For days after days after days. And yet, he never cursed God. He questioned why all this was happening, but he never cursed God. He maintained his integrity. As far as Satan was concerned, this proved Satan wrong. Not that there weren't other issues being dealt with by God, but this proved Satan was very wrong. There are people in the world who would have fulfilled Satan's prophecy. We probably have rubbed shoulders with that type in our lifetimes. People who, once they lost their blessings, or once they lost their comfort zone in the church, they were bewildered. They didn't know how to handle it. They wandered off. Some of them even threw up their hands and have no further interest in religion at all, any kind of religion. And there are those who maintained their integrity, as Job did. So Satan would have been right with some people, but not right with others. There was the big distinction. God knew Job's heart. Satan did not. Job sat there in a miserable state. And three friends came to him. Now, these friends were also patriarchs. They were important religious figures of the day. They were well-versed in theological issues. You can see that from their diatribes when they spoke to Job. And they had three rounds apiece with Job. They laid out their case. Job responded and refuted a lot of what they were saying. And they went around, each one, the elder first and the younger later. Huge dialogues between these people. Now, this was after Job and they sat there when they first came to him. And he mentions none of his friends and family came. And we'll see Job had a big family. It isn't obvious until we read the last chapter. But he was basically alone except for these three friends. And the three friends proved to be no friends at all. But they sat there in silence for 7 days. Imagine that. Job's in pain. He is racked with huge mental turmoil, mental anguish for days. Before the friends began to give their opinions as to what was wrong with him. I mean, Job, you must have sinned. Look at what's happened to you. God wouldn't do this to a righteous man. You can't be righteous. And he had to refute all of their ideas. Finally, after the three were done, a young man entered the conversation. Man named Elihu, might have been a teenager, we don't know, who had some interesting insights that the other three intellectuals, religious intellect of the day, didn't see. And he basically put a greater perspective on the matters. And as Elihu spoke, it kind of blended into another scene where there was this whirlwind. And out of the whirlwind, God spoke to Job. He revealed himself to Job in ways that apparently Job had never considered before. The Lord, out of the whirlwind, also condemned Job's three friends, who were supposed to be comforters, and they turned out to be antagonistic. They did nothing to help Job. But after the experience, after the message that the Lord gave to Job, he saw things in a light that he never saw before. And there he concluded by admitting to the Lord that he repents. That was the overall objective, I think, of the whole book. Job came to know his Lord. Job came to know God in a personal way that he had never known before. You see, Job's orientation to God was through his own personal commitment to be righteous to the degree that he could, humanly, in all things. Fine of and by itself, but it's not the complete picture. Now think about that. Because as we approach the days of unleavened bread, there is somewhat of a parallel there. Putting out leaven and taking in unleavenedness. Do you see the veiled parallel there? Something to think about. I see I got to move on a little bit here, so let's go through. I want to take and hit some highlights in the book of Job. I was going to go through this chapter by chapter and sort of give the gist of it, but I think this would be more important. What I want to show is Job understood things that were out of character to his time. They were to some degree out of character with most of the Old Testament period before the time of Moses. Job understood certain things, and we can find some of them. Job 5, verse 17, "Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects." You see, the gods of the day didn't correct in that sense. The gods of the day would have maybe shown favors if you did the right things. They might kill you if you did the wrong things. It shows a picture of God that is different. "Happy is the man whom God corrects." Verse 18, "For he makes sore and binds up. He wounds, and his hands make whole." Job understood healing, did he not? That verse would tend to suggest that. Let's go on to Job 6, verse 8. "Oh, that I might have my request, and God would grant me the things that I long for." Job understood that God answers prayer. Which of the pagan gods could that be said for? Let's drop down to Job 7, verse 9. "As the cloud is consumed and vanishes away, so he that goes down to the grave shall come up no more." Job understood the real state of death. It wasn't any immortal soul. Verse 11 of the same chapter, "Therefore I will not refrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul." This sort of shows the state of mind that Job was in at the time. Verse 21 of chapter 7. Job is asking, "And why do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity?" Job understood the forgiveness of sin. Think how far back in history this was. How did he know these things? Chapter 9, verse 20. If I justify myself, mine own mouth shall condemn me. If I say, I am perfect, it shall also prove me perverse. Profound. He knew that declaring his own sinlessness was, as Paul said, a pile of crud. Job understood that you can't pronounce yourself guiltless because it could never be true. Many, many things that he understood. Let's move up to Job 13, verse 15. And this, I think, is an astounding statement where he says, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. But I will maintain mine own ways before him. He also shall be my salvation. For an hypocrite shall not come before him. Job understood the sense that our lives are in his hands, whether good or bad. As he said earlier, blessed be the name of the Lord. We have to accept what we're given. God knows. He knows all things. Let's move on to verse 13 of the same chapter. Oh, that thou would hide me in the grave, that thou would keep me secret until your wrath is past, that you would appoint me a set time and remember me. Picture what he's saying here. If a man die, shall he live again? All the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change come. You will call, and I will answer you. You will have a desire to the work of your hands. Job understood that human life is created by God, and the work God intends to do in us is to correct us and to perfect us. Job understood something. But you notice in the sense of this, he's referring to the resurrection. In conversation with one of the fellows down there in Auburndale who has studied the book of Job extensively, he said he found a reference, what he thinks is, one reference is to the first resurrection, and another reference is to the second. Let's move on. Chapter 19, verses 25 and on. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though worms, and though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another, though my reins be consumed within me. Here again, Job is revealing that he understood that this first physical lifetime is not all, that there will be a resurrection. Ordinarily written at a different time, we wouldn't think that's so profound. But considering how far back, more than 2,000 years B.C., this is being written. Just a little side point, we can go up to verse 14 of Job 19, where he talks about his friends and relatives. My kinsfolk have failed, and my familiar friends have forgotten me. When Job's affliction came on him, they couldn't stay far enough away. As opposed to what we read in chapter 42, verse 11, let's just flip ahead to that for the moment. 42:11. Where it says, then came there unto him all his brethren and all his sisters. Job had more than two brothers and sisters. They had nothing to do with him while he was in his afflicted state. And all they that had been his acquaintance before, and they did eat bread with him. This is after he's restored to his prosperous state again. And did eat bread with him in his house. And they bemoaned him. Oh, they were sympathetic then. And comforted him. Oh, yeah, then. Over all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him, every man also gave him a piece of money, and every one an earring of gold. Earrings back then weren't microscopic. These were good-sized pieces of gold. But it sort of gives the picture. In the world, we have friends that are genuine, even our own relatives sometimes, that when we're afflicted, they may or may not be with us. But Job understood the resurrection. He understood that he will stand in the latter day upon the earth. He knew that God, that through Christ, was going to be on this planet himself. Not just off up in heaven. Job understood that. In Job 21, he's responding to Zophar. And this is where he refers to how the wicked prosper. And that's incongruous when we think through the basic idea that you obey God, he'll bless you, and disobey God, he will curse you. This kind of addresses the obvious that no, the wicked prosper without being what we would normally think. Job 21, verse 2. Hear diligently my speech, and let them be your consolations. Suffer me that I may speak, and after that I have spoken, mock on. Verse 7, wherefore do the wicked live, become old? Yea, are mighty in power. The wicked are powerful in this world. Their seat is established in their sight with them, and their offspring before their eyes. Their families, their children are prominent also. Their houses are safe from fear, neither is the rod of God upon them. Verse 13, they spend their days in wealth, and in a moment go down to the grave. They die suddenly. They don't go through agonizing health issues for months after month, it seems. When it's time, they die peacefully in their sleep or whatever. No apparent punishment in their case. Therefore they say unto God, depart from me, for we desire not the knowledge of your ways. This is the wicked speaking. What is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what profit should we have if we pray unto him? Verse 26 of Job 21. They shall lie down alike in the dust, and the worm shall cover them. He's saying the righteous and the wicked die both the same. An obvious observation. Let's move on to chapter 26. Something else revealing. Job understood, by his spirit he has garnished the heavens. In other words, he's placed the array of stars, constellations in the heavens. His hand has formed the crooked serpent. Lo, these are parts of his ways, but how little a portion is heard of him. But the thunder of his power, who can understand? Who hasn't been outdoors and had a lightning strike nearby, and you hear the tremendous report of the lightning, of the thunder, and not had some thought of the power of God? Job 27, verse 2. this whole passage down to verse 10 has got an interesting component in it. And this is one of Job's lengthy discourses. Verse 2, "And God lives who has taken away my judgment, and the Almighty who has vexed my soul." Question. Is God and the Almighty one and the same being? Or is he alluding to two different beings? God as opposed to the Almighty. The way it's worded, it would tend to say that he's talking about two different beings. Did Job understand the two-person Godhead? Down to verse 10. Well, let's read that whole passage. I think that's worth reading. "As God lives, who has taken away my judgment, and the Almighty who has vexed my soul. All the while my breath is in me, and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils. My lips shall not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. God forbid that I should justify you till I die. I will not remove mine integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. Will God," verse 9, "will God hear his cry when troubles come upon him? Will he delight himself in the Almighty? Will he always call upon God?" Again, a dual reference. And I just pose that as a question. Did Job understand the dual nature of the Godhead? Considering how far back this is, that would be a profound thing if he did. Let's move up to Job 31, where Job is continuing his discourse. Verse 2, "For what portion of God is there from above? And what inheritance of the Almighty from on high?" Again, mentioning two beings. Is God and the Almighty one and the same? Or is he alluding to two different beings? Let's move on to chapter 34. Again, a dual reference. Verse 12. "Yea, surely God will not do wickedly, neither will the Almighty pervert judgment." That's basically it as far as the doctrinal issues that are alluded to in the book of Job. Chapter 42 is basically the conclusion. Job answers the Lord. "Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do everything and that no thought can be withholden from you." He understands our circumstance. He understands at all times what we're thinking. Verse 5, "I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes." Job's trial came to an end. Verse 10 to the end of the book, we can read of that. "And the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. Also the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came unto him all his brethren and all his sisters, and they all had been of his acquaintance before." We read that. Oh, all of his friends and acquaintances were friends again. Understand that. "So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning. For he had 14,000 sheep and 6,000 camels," and so on. "He also had 7 additional sons and 3 additional daughters." His wife had 20 kids. Okay. Count them, 10 before. Okay, and then he had 10 more. I think that makes 20. Huh? Well, that's another thing in the book of Job. You don't see anything about multiple wives. Okay? That I didn't come along till later, apparently. But that's another subject. But yeah, probably the same wife. Doesn't mention any other. I mean, I can see why he might want another when you consider what she said to him up front. You know, curse God and die, you bum. You know. But, you know. Anyway, he had 20 kids altogether, but 10 in the end. And apparently his three daughters were the most beautiful women in the land, if you read the rest of that. And after he lived 140 more years and saw his sons and his sons' sons, even four generations. So Job died being old and full of days. We don't tend to refer to the book of Job a lot, but as you can see, there is a lot in it. And it's certainly a worthwhile read. It's long, you can't read it all in one sitting. And certainly, section by section, it's worth pondering. That's certainly needed with the book of Job. A lot of reflection, a lot of meditation. But it contains a lot of important truths. But it addresses the issues of life. We're not going to always be in a happy state. We're not going to always be in good health. Every one of us, at some point in time, our body's going to betray us, and we're going to be facing what Job faced. It's just the way it is. But learning from the experience and carrying through to the end and meeting our final days with the integrity and with the grace that Job ultimately showed, that is our great accomplishment. So think on these things. Read Job when you get a chance. But it certainly is an important book, and when we understand its antiquity, it is especially interesting. Hope you enjoyed that. I kind of enjoyed giving it, but enough for that. Thank you for listening.